Yes, I'd like to, very much.
No, I don't think so.
I read a poem of you and thought of his last week. A poem of his and thought of you. You'll be fine, yeah.
This is great. I mean, I love E. Cummings. Yes, I can't let you do this.
I'd love to get you this. And maybe we could discuss.
That's it, go back.
I've never influenced anybody to the best of my knowledge in any way. So when I see people making films, they make them like Scorsese makes them, they make them like Spielberg makes them, they make them like Stanley Kubrick made them. I make my films for my own enjoyment, my own therapy.
In Toronto, Canada, I'm the Mad Hatter.
And from London in England, this is Simon Collum, and this is The Film Locker. This week, we're going to be talking about Woody Allen. Woody Allen was born December the 1st, 1935, in New York City. Now, this is a pretty big deal because the vast majority of his films have been based in and around New York, notably Manhattan. Outside of cinema, Woody Allen has been incredibly prolific. In 1961, Allen broke into comedy, debuting at the Greenwich Village Club called The Duplex. He wrote stories and cartoon captions for The New Yorker, inspired by, amongst others, Max Schulman and Robert Benchley. Even in 1966, he became a successful Broadway playwright with his play Don't Drink the Water. This was adapted for the cinema, starring Jackie Gleason, with Howard Morris directing. In 1969, Allen wrote Play It Again, Sam. The Broadway version starred Woody Allen himself, Diane Keaton, and Anthony Roberts. But the film, directed by Herbert Ross in 1972, gave Allen, Keaton, and Roberts the chance to reprise those roles. Woody Allen's directorial debut was What's Up, Tiger Lily, again in 1966. Allen has also appeared in Casino Royale, the James Bond spoof, before directing it again in Take the Money and Run in 1969. His early films, between 1971 and 1975, Woody Allen starred, wrote and directed, included Bananas and Sleeper. These are deemed formless comedy in the tradition of the Marx Brothers. 1977 saw the release of Annie Hall, one of the few comedies to ever win Best Picture at the Academy Awards. This golden age of Woody Allen additionally saw the release of Manhattan, his love letter to New York. These two seminal works became the high bar Woody Allen set for himself, influencing countless films and comedians in the process. Woody Allen has mentioned many times how some of his biggest influences include Ingmar Bergman and Federico Fellini. Their philosophical nature influenced his films in the 1980s, most noticeably in September, Another Woman and Radio Days. Woody Allen's private life often appears to filter into his movie making. The older man and younger woman relationship, constantly appearing in many films, strikes a strange parallel with Woody Allen's relationship with Soon Yi Previn, a woman who is 32 years younger than Allen. More shocking is how Previn was originally Woody Allen's stepdaughter for many years. Mia Farrow and Woody Allen were in a relationship for 12 years and never got married, so you could argue Allen was never actually stepfather to any of their adopted children. It is clear that his private life and films are inextricably linked, but it is fair to say that nobody is as brutally honest as Woody Allen. His films sometimes reach sky high with profound philosophical sentiments, but at other points hit rock bottom with plodding plots and samey characters. Having said this, no one can write and direct a film like Woody Allen. Okay, so that should give you a bit of a rough outline as to Woody Allen's kind of back catalogue, his history, his experience. Now, I chose him personally because I think his films, I don't think there's any other filmmaker like him. There's certain things he can do. There's certain things I think he can get away with. There's certain things which are effective and some things which are not so effective. But there's no other filmmaker like him.
The only other director who I think is somewhat like him, but there's not the humor and there's not the humanistic sensibility is Robert Altman.
Okay.
You know, just in terms of having a lot of voices and in terms of focusing on on everyday sort of situations. I do see a little bit of Robert Altman in Woody Allen's work, but of course they are very, very different and they come at their stories different ways. Other than that, you're quite right. He's very much one of a kind.
And more importantly, he's so prolific. So on the one side, it's very difficult to, you know, narrow down specific films to watch.
Is there anybody who's seen all of his films?
I think, well, I'd like to be one of those people.
If you have seen all of his films, email us. I would love to talk about that.
If you do like his films, there's something which you do have. There is a certain consistency in his tone, in his themes, in things that he talks about, stuff about relationships, stuff about like profound, bigger aspects, attitudes towards art, all those different things. And I'm an art teacher, and I think, you know, some things are really, really fascinating insights into these aspects.
Yeah, he's very, very, you mentioned it already, relationships. He's very, very fascinated with the way we relate to one another, with the way friends relate, with the way lovers relate, with the way that families relate. And you know, they're all very, very complicated, but they're all very real. Like, a lot of his stories, they seem very plausible. It's difficult to turn that into a fascinating film.
People go on about saying, well, they claim it's a flaw that often, obviously, his films are set in very affluent areas of society, people who have a lot of money, and I think often, you know, often in New York. The reality is that the reason why these films, you know, have such a, you know, similar kind of context, I guess, is because so it can focus exclusively on the actual relationships. I mean, these are people who don't need to worry about, you know, where their next paycheck is coming from. It's talking about people who they might have even reached what they wanted from life and actually had a family, and yet it then deals with, okay, but what about if this happens? Or what about if that happens? And those little changes or relationship factors are things which would affect everyone. But I think it hones in on those relationship things. And that's what's so fascinating as well.
Yeah, but at the same time, I must admit, that is one thing that I find very, very difficult about a Woody Allen film, is that a lot of the time, because it deals with affluent people, I have trouble relating. Like, there are... I do have to deal with moments where I just want to turn it off and say, oh, you know, like, shut up, you rich, pretentious assholes. But so that is the one difficulty that I do have trouble getting past sometimes, although I usually just kind of bear down and make it through eventually.
You're watching a Woody Allen film and you think it's about the, you know, the state of their life in terms of their financial, you know, situation, then it's the wrong reasons, isn't it? I mean, because it is about those personal ticks and the relationships, you know, primarily. And that's what makes it so fascinating. I think certain things like Melinda and Melinda is the most recent film which I've watched of his. And that's a film which it is flawed. But the reality is that it is a film which nevertheless has a very, you know, it's the idea of a tragedy on the one side and a comedy on another. And you could just imagine sitting there thinking of, oh, it would be really interesting to see X film and show these situations. And he obviously has the clout now to effectively do that. But I think, you know, in terms of all the detail, in terms of the context, in terms of what they earn and their jobs and all those types of things, you know what I mean? I don't think he wants to dwell on that. And I think it's the easiest way to deal with it if these people have got pretty much everything, so that it does, you know, so that it could just exclusively focus on these relationships.
My first experience, he was a byproduct of my going through the AFI Top 100 back in 98 or so. So I would have first heard about him through Annie Hall. Which I didn't really get it at the time, to be entirely honest. So this would have been around the time I was 20 or so. I thought it was nice. I just didn't really understand the appeal. I came back to it a few years later. I came back to it about 4 or 5 years later, around 2003, 2004, and then I really, really actually appreciated the humor, appreciated the self-deprecation, appreciated the very dry wit of Annie Hall. And around that same time was when I went to see Match Point in a theater. That was the first Woody Allen film that I saw in a theater, and that I just loved. I thought that film was beautifully crafted, that film had a fabulous script, and that it was strangely, I don't know how often this comes up in his canon, because I haven't seen all of these 35, 40 films, but that it was a really, really sexy picture, too.
To be honest, sexy girls, Woody Allen does have an eye for the women. I'd agree with regards to Annie Hall. Annie Hall was my first starting point, and I think in the exact same way, it was a case of, you know, getting through a list of must-see films of some sort, and Annie Hall was one of them. And to be honest, as soon as I put it on, and the opening as Woody Allen talks directly to camera, and it goes from there, and then the really quick cutting of it shows his childhood and the jokes and the little kids, you know, saying what they became when they were older. The one girl sitting there going, I like leather.
Sometimes I wonder where my classmates are today.
I'm president of the Pincus Plumbing Company.
I sell tallises.
I used to be a heroin addict. Now I'm a methadone addict.
I'm into leather.
incredible. And I was laughing so much, and I was just sold right on that. And I think from there, I watched the early stuff like Bananas, like Manhattan, amongst others. You know, and I kind of, from there, I kind of thought, no, I really, really like his style. And I like his attitude. I like his the neurosis nature of him just constantly analysing himself. I think I analyse myself too much, psychoanalyse myself too much. So that's something which I think is really interesting and makes me like his films. But I think let's move on. We got this. We've chosen, normally, we obviously chose a film which represents the director the best. And we've chosen this week, Hannah and Her Sisters.
Jesus, if I have a brain tumor, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Don't have a brain tumor. He didn't say he had a brain tumor.
No, naturally, they're not going to tell you because, well, you know, sometimes the weaker ones will panic if
but
you tell them.
But not you.
Oh, God. You were buzzing. Is there a buzzing?
Mickey, come on. We got a show to do.
I can't keep my mind on the show.
But there's nothing wrong with you.
If there's nothing wrong with me, then why does he want me to come back for tests?
He has to rule out certain things.
Like what? What?
I don't know. Cancer.
Don't say that. I don't want to hear that word. Don't mention that while I'm in the building.
But you don't have any symptoms.
I got the classic symptoms of a brain tumor.
2 months ago, you thought you had a malignant melanoma.
Naturally, I the sudden appearance of a black spot on my back.
It was on your shirt.
Okay, so that was a little clip from Hannah and Her Sisters. And this is one of Woody Allen's films which does have a lot of critical acclaim. I mean, obviously, a lot of them at this time period did have. Hannah and Her Sisters is from 1986. Manhattan was 79. And Annie Hall was 77. So between that time period, that was kind of, if you were to say, his golden age of film. I think that would be fair to say. Do you think?
I think so. It was certainly an era during from like 79 through to about 1990, 1991 was an era where he was certainly very much loved by the Academy. It seemed like just about everything he did garnered multiple Academy Award nominations.
Including Hannah and Her Sisters.
Including Hannah and Her Sisters, yeah.
And this film is specifically, obviously, we've got this character, Hannah, who's played by Mia Farrow, who obviously Woody Allen was in a relationship for many, many years, and she stars in a lot of his films. And whilst at the same time it shows Hannah and her sisters, Lee, played by Barbara Hershey, and Holly, by Diane West. Is it West or Weest?
It's Weest, actually.
Weest, there we go. And at the same time, we've also got Michael Caine in his role as Elliot. This is basically a very Woody Allen-esque character, which is the thing you see a lot of. But at the same time, you have Woody Allen in the film as well, playing a character called Mickey. All these different characters' lives are intertwined. You know, they all have different voiceovers at different points as well, and it's got the same type of things as Woody Allen has in it, with his jazz music, big kind of brassy music is in there, and it's also got that comedy and drama balance. What did you think of it?
I actually watched it for the first time for this show, so this was thank you for introducing me to Hannah and Her Sisters. Not like the Goodfellas episode where I knew that one by verse. This one's very, very new to my film literacy. I quite enjoyed it. I would definitely put this up amongst the best Woody Allen films that I've seen. Very, very complicated look at what people's relationships. Not quite as complicated as something like Husbands and Wives, which I think almost overcomplicates the matter. But just when you get people who all run in similar circles, the relationships with each other tend to kind of spill over onto one another. It's kind of like if you imagine, you know, you've got one of your best friends and then your best friend gets married. Well, after a year or two, the wife or the husband, they become your friend as well. So it's like, you know, it's not here's my best friend's wife, it's oh, here's my friend, you know?
Because there's so many different characters in it, you get this different idea of all these different attitudes to these relationships. And because they're all so close and connected, you just don't know who's going to kind of affect who.
The other cool thing I like is how it shows how much restlessness can lead to some really, really poor decisions. And, you know, everything from, you think your marriage is in a rut, to you don't know what you're doing professionally, to your family just not going down the road that you think they should be going down, and how it can lead to some really, really bad ideas. There are moments where we watch these characters, you know, make a move, as it were, not necessarily like a sexual move, although that comes into it too, but we watch them make a move and we just watch going, oh, why are you doing that? And we have to laugh just out of pity for what these characters are doing, and he really, really captures that very, very well.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think Hannah, at the center of it all, is a very interesting role in that, to some extent, she's somebody, she's a very giving person, she's very supportive, she's very loving and very caring. The other characters, Lee and Elliot and Holly and Mickey, they all have these really, like, really big insecurities, which they're, to some extent, acting on in a big way. Hannah is trying to be as caring as possible, and to some extent is being used in the process.
We haven't really talked too much about Michael Caine in this movie as Elliot, and I really think that he's very, as much as Hannah and the sisters, he is very much the engine that drives this movie. He's acting on obsession. He's projecting an awful lot onto Lee, even though she seems to be up for being projected upon, but he's projecting his restlessness onto a connection that may or may not be there. And I really love the moment where he there's a great scene where he almost tracks her down. He's hanging out in her neighborhood of New York City, which is, we get the impression, very well out of the way for him. And he's just kind of lurking about and on the street, not far from where he knows is her door. And when he sees her leave, he runs and he catches up with her. It's a scene that's actually echoed in The Brothers McMullen, if you've ever seen that film.
No, I haven't. No.
Okay, Edward Burns' film from about 95, 96. And same sort of idea where there's an infidelity taking place and the husband sees the object of his affection. He just kind of hangs out in her neighborhood and he runs after her. And it leads to this wonderful scene where they're in a bookstore. So he talks about a poem of E.E. Cummings, and he finds the book, and he basically sees something in her that he knows he wants. That's possibly because it encapsulates little things about her sister, about Hannah.
Between lust and what love is.
Yes.
What are they? And the thing is that obviously, and to some extent, how you may need both. That he clearly lusts after Lee, whilst his love is obviously with Hannah. And that's where Michael Caine's delivery and execution of that role is incredible. I mean, a really great choice to play, you know, unsure, insecure character.
Now, Woody Allen, of course, is in this film. This is one that he wrote, direct, and acted in himself. And he plays a hypochondriac, of course, named Mickey Sachs. And he's not really driving this story. He's in the mix, but he's not the engine of Hannah and her sisters. But what I loved about Mickey's story, what actually had me laughing out loud about Mickey's story, is that Mickey, after going through a bit of a cancer scare, he has a crisis of faith, and he's deciding that perhaps Judaism isn't the answer for him. So he decides, he flirts with a conversion to Catholicism, which is just, along with him standing in the church and going back and forth and just exposing himself bewildered to all this pageantry, we see when he finally decides to pull the trigger on this conversion that he comes home and he's unpacking his bag of his items that he'll need to convert to Catholicism, and along with a crucifix and a picture of Christ, he unpacks a loaf of white, like, Wonder Bread and a jar of mayonnaise.
But the thing is that it's quite funny because Mickey's character is virtually not in the main story of it. Like you said, it's like you have all these different kind of conflicts between Elliot and Lee, and it's more about him trying to work out who he is and about approaching death so soon and etc. I mean, rather than his relationship directly with Holly, though that's a factor. I never felt like that was at the forefront of it. And again, this is why it's really, I think it's a good choice to discuss Woody Allen with, because it's a film where he's talking about those kind of more profound sides to things. But at the same time, it also deals with the relationship side of things. And it plays around with these things within that comedic way, which obviously Woody Allen's so great at doing. You've got some nice sequences in it. One bit I thought where there's a round table kind of pan when they're having a conversation. And that, I think, was just, I mean, I was thinking about Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs and obviously the little bit in Death Proof. And I just thought that that was something which was really, really well shot. And again, this is another thing which I love about Woody Allen, is that you'll often see these very clever use of the camera and very interesting use of delivery. So in the same way in Husbands and Wives, you have this documentary like approach where you suddenly have these talking heads talking about things. You know, I mean, Woody Allen has no problems in just playing around with the camera in these different ways and having these continually running sequences.
You don't get the sense with films like this and even recently with You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger or Annie Hall, we don't get the sense that we're watching a scene as much as we get the idea that we're in the scene ourselves, because he'll take the camera right into the room and he'll let columns get in the way. He'll let, like, there's a moment in Hannah and Her Sisters where Mia Farrow as Hannah, she's her face is completely blocked out by a colander that's sitting right forefront of the shot. It's a really great device that really, really brings us into these stories, and it's not something that you see too often with other directors. Maybe I mentioned earlier Robert Altman, sometimes you see that. P.T. Anderson, when it comes to films like Magnolia and Boogie Nights, he copies that as well. But it's really, really a great trick to bring the audience right into the story and feel like we're in these rooms with these people listening to these conversations. Really encapsulates a lot of the different facets of Woody Allen's films. Like you have the dry, witty humor of stuff like, you know, like the white bread and the mayonnaise, or, you know, I can't explain why God created Nazis, I don't know how to work the can opener. Stuff like that, you know. And it also encapsulates the fragility of human relationships and the complicatedness and just the drama that can come with just everyday life. It really brings together all the different things that he does in one film.
And I think at the same time, it's nice as well that this has got a really nice reference to a Ingmar Bergman film. And obviously, Bergman's a huge influence on Woody Allen. Woody Allen tried to do his Bergman, as it were, with interiors. In Hannah and Her Sisters, it starts off with Thanksgiving and ends with Thanksgiving. Fanny and Alexander has Christmas at the start and Christmas at the end. And so he has. So you've got the influence of his films. You've got some themes which are reoccurring. You've got a nice combination in the fact that you have a Woody Allen role in there, but you also have a Michael Caine effectively playing a Woody Allen role again. So you have that's nice in there as well. So I think it's a really great introduction to the diversity of Woody Allen's films.
I was just absolutely enchanted by this movie, that there's a lot of really funny stuff. Diane Wiest doing such wonderful things with Holly, where she's just a little bit rudderless, even though she's passionate. You know, she wants to be an actress. She wants to be a writer. She doesn't know what she wants to do. She doesn't know what she wants in a man. She just knows that she wants a man and how much that seems to draw everybody else in.
You think about Christina as well in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, and she's this kind of artist who wants to do all these things. She's a photographer, but then she likes the painting and all that type of thing. Again, it's that, you know, that character who's struggling with their art.
Yeah, I think we've all met somebody like this who just has so much energy but just can't pick an outlet and stick to it. That it, you know, all of this, it all adds up for a really, really wonderful film.
Yeah. Okay, let's dig into some of his back catalogue and get to our top shelf soon enough. No puedo seguir inventando que el mundo sea otra cosa. So we've talked a lot about Woody Allen's film Hannah and Her Sisters as the kind of the ultimate, as it were, Woody Allen film, opposed to his best. Now, we obviously know a lot, his best is often quoted as being Manhattan or Annie Hall, but he's also got a lot of maybe dry points, probably the best way to put it. So what do you think, Mad Hatter? What would you say is maybe his weaker films?
Well, for me, and now that I look at this, I actually rethink. Earlier when we were talking about our introductions to Woody Allen, my introduction probably was Everyone Says I Love You, which came out in 96. This was at the height of Edward Norton's rise to fame. This was around the same time that he did The People versus Larry Flint and Primal Fear. So I went into watching Everyone Says I Love You, you know, out of wanting to see more of Edward Norton. As a musical, it doesn't really entirely work. It's a very loving attempt for me, and not everybody who's in it can sing all that well. Julia Roberts is particularly difficult to get through.
I mean, at the same time, I think a weak film I thought when I first watched it was Husbands and Wives.
And really?
And when I first watched it, I found it very difficult to get. And now the more I've thought about it and the more I've dwelled on it, the more I've actually thought, actually, no. I mean, you know, there's that bit with Sidney Pollack and the girl when he's like dragging her out of that.
that's a painful scene, man.
But it's incredible.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It really is. And then when I think back to that, I thought, no, that was very good. And then I think about some of the other things to it as well. And I just think, no. And the idea of how the film starts and the actual end of it and whatnot. And that's really good as well. So it's difficult. I mean, that's one which I remember I bought it and then I sold it because I didn't like it. But now I'm like thinking, actually, maybe I was wrong on that. Mighty Aphrodite is another one I found quite weird because you've got this whole Greek chorus. It starts off with this adopted child. And so it had the idea that the child is not literally sleeping with the mother, but to some extent there's a side to it which is like that. So it's almost like Oedipus and that Greek tragedy element. Ew. So that comes up time and time again. But it's difficult because there's this kind of, in the same way with the girl in Whatever Works, and in a lot of the films, there's this kind of prostitute girl in there, and there's a bit when Woody Allen gets it on with the prostitute, and by that point you're kind of like, oh, come on, you know, do you have to always get it on with the girls, Woody Allen? You know what I mean? That's quite weird to watch.
It's the beauty of writing and directing your own film, right?
Exactly, exactly. But then again, I love the honesty in a lot of this stuff, because I think it's so honest, it's awkward to some extent, and so on. It's not necessarily to me, not that I can relate, obviously, but in terms of what he's trying to say and what he's doing, he is trying to present these very, very real things. And he seems to do that very well, and I commend him for it, because obviously he doesn't care what people think. He'll just make it anyway. He doesn't care that it's a bit weird that he's going out with a younger girl in whichever film, in Manhattan, in you know, in half the films where he suddenly is it Husbands and Wives when he gets it with that, gets together with that girl under candlelight. And again, that whole film, you know that's coming, and you know that Woody Allen's kind of, to some extent, the character Woody Allen plays is kind of like, oh, I don't know, and I probably won't, and all that kind of thing. And you're thinking, oh, good, that's good. And then he does kiss her.
And then the funny thing is that if you go back to You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, in essence, in that movie, Josh Brolin is playing the Woody Allen part.
Yes.
And what happens? He gets together with the ingenue, played by Frida Pinto.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, every time.
Again, on the one side, it's like, oh, come on, it's the same thing again. But you just know that he's just thinking, no, I'm going to do this. It works for my story, which I want to tell. And he's not making any concessions. I think at the centre, obviously, Annie Hall, I think there's no point in going on about Annie Hall because everybody knows it's brilliant. It is great. It's got some incredible innovative techniques in it. The subtitles when they're trying to show what they're really thinking. The funny bit with the lobsters, that's incredibly good. You know, another film I think is brilliant is Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid to Ask.
That's one of his earlier zany comedies, right?
Oh, it's great. They split it into these different seven different sections, and there's one bit with Gene Wilder, whereby he falls in love with a sheep. So, but it is, you watch that, it's so funny, really, really brilliant. So that would probably be some of my recommendations. And obviously you discussed Match Point, which I think is incredible as well. But yeah, okay, what about your top shelf choice? So if you're going to pull one from the top shelf, what would it be?
Well, if I'm going to pull one off the top shelf of the locker, mine has to be Manhattan for many, many different reasons. Living in a big city, and I think you'll probably relate to this as well, living in London as well, living in one of the world's greatest cities, there's a lot of very, very personal conversations that happen in very, very public places. You find that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, like, you'll be on a subway, or you'll be on, like, in a park. You'll be in very, very public places, and you'll be talking about, you know, losing your job, or you'll be talking about your relationship breaking up, or you'll be talking about people who you're falling in love with, or new people you've met, and it's all happening while you're just surrounded by dozens or hundreds of people going here and there about the city. And I love the way that that's captured in Manhattan, where all of these very very deep conversations about who these people are and what they're wanting and where they're going wrong, they're happening on the street side, or they're happening in on, like, you know, very crowded bars, that kind of thing. I love the way that Manhattan captures that.
And the whole look of the film is also incredible. The black and white, it just really frames it in this such a beautiful light. And the big band, the George Gershwin kind of score as well. I mean, absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it is. And the other thing that's really, really cool is last episode we talked very, very briefly about Taxi Driver, And the cool thing about both Taxi Driver and Manhattan is that they are love letters to the New York City that does not exist anymore. If you were to go to Manhattan now, hoping to have moments from the film Manhattan, you're not really going to have that, because the city has been cleaned up. The city has been, you know, Disney-fied, if that's a word. In this kind of film, doesn't celebrate the grimy aspect of Manhattan the same way the Taxi Driver does, but it has a much faster, a much dirtier type of Manhattan that exists today. And in some ways, I kind of miss that era of New York City. And Manhattan really captures that very well. The other thing I love about Manhattan, and maybe I see some conversations that I've had in this moment, is his character, Isaac Davis. When he first meets Diane Keaton's character, Mary Wilkie, she's going on and on and on about people and artists and entities that are overrated, and she's just absolutely talking shit and being so over pretentious, and it's so funny just to watch him struggle to bite his tongue the first time that he meets this woman. And it's a wonderful moment and a wonderful introduction. What about you? What's on your top shelf?
My top shelf is Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Nice.
You mentioned Match Point, how sexy Match Point is. I think exactly the same with Vicky Cristina Barcelona, but I think the difference is with Vicky Cristina Barcelona, it's rooted in this very art world, which obviously I love so much. And I think it's also a good one to choose because obviously, you know, Woody Allen works within the New York context for so much of his films. This kind of European phase is going through with London and Barcelona and Paris and all this stuff. You know what I mean? It's a really different, you know, state of affairs to see. And I think Vicky Cristina Barcelona looks stunning. The whole thing is just beautiful to look at. Whilst at the same time, the story again about art and what is art and what is love and what is right and wrong within that, and whether you can be an artist without being too crazy, and do you have to be a bit mad to really be a real artist, and whatever is a real artist. And yet you see some beautiful art within there, and the idea of photography and what photography is and whether that's real art. And and yet you've got Rebecca Hall in this other side of it as this kind of almost this art historian studying Gaudi and trying to research that, and what's that about? Somebody who really appreciates art. Is that right? I love the film. I think it looks stunning. It's like every single time I watch it, it's like getting it, that whole pure escapism. People go on about Star Wars being escapism. I mean, I think Vicky Cristina Barcelona is escapism. You're going on holiday, you're with these very artistic people, and you've got I love it. I mean, Midnight in Paris, I think, is shaping up to be quite good. I mean, Owen Wilson looks like his delivery of Woody Allen's neurotic dialogue is impeccable.
Yeah, and by the hopefully we'll both get a chance to see that very soon, so we'll both have a chance to write about it too.
Exactly. So let's move on to the final part of the podcast, where we'll be discussing the trivia questions and how you can take part as well. So as we did last week with the Martin Scorsese trivia, you'll already know that the news is already on the board. It's already on the blog, so you can see whether you're in the lead and whether you're on track to be getting that free Blu-ray or DVD, because that is the prize at the end of this. But obviously, it's going to be a case of over the course of these weeks, we're going to see how many questions people can get right. So the next, obviously, the trivia is about Woody Allen. You've got three questions there, Mad Hatter.
I do, so put your Woody Allen thinking caps on. The first question is, Annie Hall got Woody Allen nominated for Oscars for writing, acting, and directing at the same time, and only one other person has done that. Who is it? The second question is, which superhero has not worked with Woody Allen? The Black Widow, Wolverine, The Incredible Hulk, or Spider-Man?
A little bit of a tricky question there. You got to think about it a little bit harder. And the final question, just to make it a little bit easier, is what song plays under the opening sequence of Manhattan?
Nice. Okay, my three questions are, first off, and this is, I always go for these number-based questions. How many films in total has Woody Allen directed, written, and features all in the same film? So that would be, you know, if he doesn't star in the film, so something like, say, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, that wouldn't count because he hasn't starred in it, though he did obviously write it and direct it. He has to have written it, directed, and starred in it. Okay?
Good call.
My second question is, which line is the following line from? The defendant did commit an adulterous act with the sheep. Most distasteful in view that the fact that the sheep was under 18 years old. Okay, so that you should know that if you're listening carefully already. And my last question is, how many films has Woody Allen directed and released that features the name of a location? Okay, so I've specified that it has to have been released already, so that my example would be Midnight in Paris. So that wouldn't count because it hasn't been released, but it obviously is a film that includes the location in the title. So how many films has he actually done which include that location in the title?
Well, those are our six questions. Remember to email your answers to filmlocker@hotmail.com, and you have a chance to win that DVD or Blu-ray. If you want to read more of Simon's writing, you can do so at screeninsight.blogspot.com.
And if you want to read more of the Mad Hatter's writing, he's obviously at the Dark of the Matinee at mcneilmatinee.blogspot.com.
And of course, there's also the blog to go along with this show, thefilmlocker.blogspot.com, where we update all sorts of content through the course of the week to complement the director of each episode.
Okay, so I'm looking forward to next week again, another director, another classic film director.
Me too. We're giving people some good options for this summer if they don't want to go out and see Green Lantern next week, or if they don't want to go out and see Cars 2 in a few weeks, they can take a Friday night in and watch some of these better movies.
Yeah, and at the same time, we'll obviously hint at what directors we will be discussing on the blog. So have a look at that Film Locker blog, because we are really going to try and make it look fantastic.
Well, in London, England, he is Simon Collum.
And in Toronto, Canada, you are Mad Hatter, I think.
I hope so. I'm wearing his shorts. Thanks for listening, okay. Everybody.